Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I've been speaking about compassion, love, and wisdom. Now I want to talk about it, about these three, more in the way Rin Master did in Zen Traditional Life. And I want to preface this by saying that I believe the reason why Rin Master wrote of them as she did in Zen's Eternal Life, and of course these are in those wonderful chapters, the heart of Avalokiteshvara, the heart of Samantabhadra, the heart of Manjushri. In the first part of Zen's Eternal Life, which is not the translations part, but the part that Rin Master wrote, and wrote most or all of it when she was still in Japan, or during a visit she made to Malaysia after she'd been in Japan a few years. I'm not sure exactly when it was written, but it was written in the early years of her training. It was written when she was a young monk still, although the depth of her understanding for someone who'd been was a young monk was simply amazing. I believe, and I've read these chapters so many times, and they've been such a help over the years. I've talked about them innumerable times. We have many recorded lectures where I've talked about them. They've been really one of the foundations of teaching for me throughout my years of training. Now I never cease to be amazed by the content, frankly. I think that she wrote these chapters because she was, at this point, a monk, not a lay trainee. And I think she was writing, it's very clear that she was writing, particularly for people who might come to a monastery to train, either as lay trainees or as monks, and particularly as Westerners coming to a Japanese Soto Zen training monastery. And finding some of what was happening in that monastery bewildering and sometimes not seemingly very fair or very kind at all. Rin Master tries to help people understand what is going on there and how useful it can be in training if the meditation and the precepts and the attitude of true willingness is applied in that training situation. But she was really at pains to illuminate how teaching is done and the attitudes with which a student or disciple must approach the teaching in order to benefit from it. In that stage of, the first stage of the heart of Avalokiteshvara, she makes it clear that the focus for the trainee is not yet that of being an active teacher. The focus is on one's own training, setting one's own house in order spiritually. Before we can help others, we have to do something about ourselves. And of course, this is always true. It's not just for a few years in the beginning and you have to concern yourself about that anymore. We always have to first try to get our own selves in hand before we give teaching to others, to try to do that which will help others. When one begins to make the transition to the more active form of love represented by the heart of Samantabhadra, again, her master makes it clear that one sometimes has to do things that are not very pleasant, and I've been talking about that in a general way. And she describes the qualities that the more senior monks are looking for in a younger monk who is beginning to do this, and the kind of willingness that they're looking for in that monk. And she puts it quite starkly at times. She talks about the willingness to let go of everything at this stage of training. To not worry about reputation, honor, wealth, health, etc. But to do that which one has come to believe through one's meditation, through one's turning to the Eternal for help, one's come to believe to be truly in the best interest of self and others, regardless of the price in worldly terms. And this is a very insecure position to put oneself in. She says that in actual fact, most priests are not very willing to do this. And it's a lot easier to be a more passive kind of priest who is gentler and kinder and is pretty well content to stay in that realm of things rather than to sometimes utilize some of the more demanding and more severe forms of teaching. And generally with the laity, and especially with newer trainees, whether lay or monastic, this is generally the best way to approach things. However, if one gets stuck in this more, in the more passive, gentle approach, the one that everyone can more easily recognize is, well, this is kind. Look how kind this person is. They speak nicely to me. They're supportive. They express faith in me. You know, they want to help me. This is a good person. Well, you only have to read the stories of the Zen masters to see that this does not hold water if you want to train people to go further. At some point, teachers have to ask more of people. And boy, people flee like the dickens when that happens. I've seen a master do that with people who were monks and had been monks for years and have that person be gone the next day. Not because their master threw him out, because a whole new world of possibilities got open to them, and some of those possibilities were not pleasant. This quality of the teacher is not one that looks like the ministering angel. Doesn't look like it to the person who's the teacher themselves when they have to do hard teaching. And it certainly doesn't feel like it to the disciple or the student, the lay trainee, whoever it is who's on the receiving end of it. The recipient has to work hard to bow to that teaching. And the master or the teacher or the priest has to work hard to give that teaching in the right way, and to accept the consequences of doing it, whether it be in what at the time the person, the teacher believes to be the best way or not. Reverend Master talks a lot about the humanity of teachers and how difficult it is for teachers to do their job fully. And I can attest to that 1,000%. know it from experience, for many years now of being a teacher. I have the greatest admiration, I have to say, for those of the people who've trained with me through the years and who stick it out. And especially those who train at close quarters with me. Not that I'm difficult to live with all the time. But it's definitely true that when I start having it come up in my meditation, and it's always something I resist in the beginning, and sometimes I resist it a lot because I know both through instinct and through experience that I'm going to have to go through it myself as I put another person through it. But I greatly admire people who are in the position of a student or a disciple and who receive that teaching, that hard teaching, and bow to it and keep looking up. And I have seen over the years the tremendous benefit in the training of the people who do that. As myself, as a disciple, I benefited from my master's firm hand at times. In actual fact, a teacher will rarely employ such teaching with people that they know to lack sufficient faith to receive that teaching. One has a pretty good instinct. However, there are times when one feels one has to give the teaching, one believes one has to be the teaching. Sometimes one simply knows with one's whole being one has to give the teaching, and one has no idea at all how it's going to be received. But it is such an important thing. And really at that point one has to be willing to accept, the teacher has to be willing to accept that whatever the consequences are, in the long run, this is going to be for the best for everyone concerned. I said accept, but I think I should say trust. You have to trust that. If you do not have that faith, you simply will not have the courage to do what you have to do. I had to do this very recently with someone who I greatly admire and love. Not a monk, by the way, but a lay trainee. And that person renounced discipleship as a result of the teaching I gave that person. Yet I know I got to the point where I had to do what I did. I had to say what I said. And one just has to live. The teacher has to live with the consequences of the actions, and the teacher has to live with, among those consequences, the sadness. People who want nifty little solutions to life problems should not be doing this. This is the way that leads to the true cessation of suffering in the fullest sense, the most ultimate sense of these words. That is no more rebirth of greed, hate, delusion of the causes of suffering. That is what the full cessation of suffering means. Does not mean that in this lifetime human beings, including Zen masters, do not suffer, do not make karma. It means that they are not perpetuating that kind of karma that results in rebirth. At least not in rebirth in the realms of suffering. Rev. Master spoke of this training, level of training, the hardest of Mantabhadra. She described it as love. And this is my experience of it. You never know how much you love someone until you are risking losing them. All of us who have family members who have died know this. It's equally true when the loss is simply some kind of more or less final separation in this lifetime. Or really any kind of separation. We don't much like being separated from those we love. This particular talk I'm giving mostly for the monks, but it's also a good talk for lay trainees who are serious in their training. Lay trainees who think that because they're lay trainees, they are somehow exempt from receiving teaching that they don't like from their priest, from the teacher, and especially from someone who they have asked to be their master and who has accepted them as a lay disciple. That person I spoke of, lay person I just spoke of, by the way, was a lay disciple of mine. Or could not have renounced discipleship. But the fact that one is a lay trainee does not automatically somehow exempt one from at least some of what monks go through. It's just that monks live at closer quarters with their teacher. And monks have made a commitment that, at least in a formal way, is a more ultimate kind of commitment. Now, of course, a lay trainee can have that kind of commitment in their heart. But lay trainees do not formally renounce the world. And the lay trainees do not do the monastic ordination ceremony where literally the disciple says, I will worship only my master and my greater self. The word worship here should be understood not as some kind of subject or abject homage, but as profound, deep respect and trust. I will worship only my master and my greater self. And a monastic disciple needs that kind of faith. A lay trainee who wants to truly go as far as they're capable of, and I'm not going to say how far that might be. It might be further than anyone else. They have to have within themselves the same kind of commitment. So this talk is really both for monks, and particularly for monks who are taking on teaching responsibilities, and for the laity. Now, obviously, I hope obviously, a teacher uses more severe methods only when it's truly necessary. And of course, teachers can get this wrong at times, and when they do, they experience deep regret when they realize they've gone too far. Sometimes teachers have to apologize. I've done it myself more than once, too. And yet, one has done what one has done. And one has to accept the consequences. It is in the acceptance, the willingness to accept the consequences and to continue on in one's training, that the great hope lies, both for the disciple and for the master, for all trainees. The willingness to accept the consequences of one's action, get up off the ground, brush oneself off, and go on. A true teacher does not keep a mental score record on the trainees. For a true teacher, every day is a fresh day. I've seen this Rim Master do this so many times. I've seen her bawl someone out, and in the next moment, say something kind to them. Teaching given, a word to the wise is sufficient, point taken, hopefully. Now let's move on. Of course, if the disciple or the student fights back, well, then they get more of the same, usually. The point is, there's a teaching here. It has to be conveyed in a way that gets through. Sometimes it's hard to get through, so one has to shout. Sometimes one can get through with very gentle means. That's the preferable way. That's the default position. But if that ain't working and the need is great enough, then stronger means are needed. But once the message is delivered, the teacher has to walk away from it. And it's part of the trust that the teacher has in the student. The teacher trusts that the student has taken it in and is going to apply the teaching. Sometimes the teacher will have to back up a teaching with a caution that, well, if this has to happen again, you know, things are going to get worse. And I've had to do that a number of times through the years. But that's definitely not the preferred way. That's only if the teacher is convinced. I just don't have proof that I'm getting through. I'll say at this point that in general, traditionally in Buddhism, and this, for some reason, this just works out this way. This is the natural way it works out, not just a kind of convention. This is not a Sangha social convention. This actually works this way. Traditionally, there are three remonstrances with a student or a disciple who is refusing to take a teaching in and apply it. And these remonstrances or remonstrations can take place sometimes within a few days and sometimes over a period of weeks or months or even years. I just say that if one becomes aware that that is happening and that there are remonstrances happening, it is really, really important not for it not to have to go to the third one. If at all possible. Because that is where the teacher will recognize. And again, the teacher may not even be counting the remonstrations, may only in retrospect realize that there were three times. I've had this happen a number of times. Only in retrospect that it happened three times. But that third time always is the most severe and can be drastic. So I always, and when I got to that second one, if I know that this process is happening, and I know I've reached number two, I am just praying in my heart that it won't go to number three. Because I know I'm going to have to do something really drastic, and I hate doing it. How is this love? How is this love? Well, just think for a moment about family life in the world. Suppose there is a family in which one member is an alcoholic, say. That's a good one because this is so common. You know, so common. In my family history, there's a lot of alcoholism coming down through the generations. My dad never touched alcohol because he was so afraid he'd might get hooked. And his father and both of his brothers are alcoholics. So I think my father was very wise in that. Some people do have a disposition toward it. Anyway, and let's not speak of it here in any judgmental way. Just view it as an illness. This is the kind of illness. And yet it's an illness that sometimes takes some remonstration to get someone to recognize that they need to do something about it. They have a name for this. I don't know if I remember quite what it is, but there's a term for this. When the family members or friends and or family get together, kind of gang up on someone and read them the riot act about their drinking or their drug use or something along these lines. It's usually drinking or drug. You know, think about the family members and the friends, you know. Is this something they want to do? No. What they want to see happen is that this person stop hurting themselves and probably hurting others as well in the process. That's what they want. They don't want to be involved. They don't want to get involved. They don't want to be the one who has to tell that person, well, if you continue this, I'm calling the police. If you continue this, I'm moving out. If you continue this, I'm throwing you out. And yet when they do it, even if they're emotionally upset at the time, most of the time, I think people are conscious how much they love this person and how much it's grieving them, they themselves, to have to do this. That is love. The person who's on the receiving end of it, it doesn't feel much like love, usually. Why are these people trying to tell me what to do, interfering in my life? Why won't they leave me alone? Why are they trying to force me to look at this? I don't want to look at this. I can't deal with it. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So to them, it doesn't look like love. And yet to the person who's doing it, generally speaking, they know it's love. Sometimes they're so fed up, they're mad at the time. But, you know, you never get that mad with someone you don't love. For this talk, I'll simply leave the third stage, the heart of Manjushri, the heart of wisdom, out of it. This talk is mostly focused on the heart of Samantabhadra, and in particular, in the way it manifests in the relationship between teacher and student, or master and disciple. Both from the master end and the disciple end, or the teacher end and the student end. And this is simply part of our education, both as students or disciples and as masters or teachers, that we have to be willing to accept this as part of our education, one of the less pleasant parts of it, and learn the lesson, the lessons, multiple lessons that are in this.
Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.